Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers. Additional KCRW programs and podcasts are available at kcrw.com.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Where are the rocket scientists when we need them? Hello again, I'm Norman Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. After the Soviet Union fired the first satellite into orbit, a crash program led the U.S. to revolutionize science and technology. Now China, India, South Korea, and Singapore put the U.S. to shame when it comes to high skills and innovation. They're churning out PhDs and pushing unfettered inquiry where the U.S. once was unrivaled. On To the Point, President Bush says his competitiveness initiative will restore American leadership, but why make cuts in basic education? Will he give with one hand and take back with the other, leaving the country in economic jeopardy? On Reporter's Notebook later on, an ignominious resignation at the world's richest art institution. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Norman Olney, back with To the Point. Business leaders and high-tech scientists are worried that America's losing its edge in technological progress. On To the Point, will China, India, and other developing countries dominate the world's economic future? Or will the president's new competitiveness initiative put America back on track? On Reporter's Notebook, the head of the Getty Trust in Los Angeles has resigned under a cloud. We'll hear about continuing problems at a $9 billion institution. First, this news update. The day after Katrina struck the Gulf Coast, President Bush famously said that New Orleans had dodged a bullet. Today, the beleaguered former director of FEMA, Michael Brown, told a Senate committee the White House knew full well what was going on because he told them. Eric Lipton is covering the hearing for the New York Times. Good to have you with us.
Hello.
It's my understanding, Mr. Brown said today, he told the White House what was going on. They didn't pay attention.
He says that after FEMA became a part of the Department of Homeland Security, there was much less attention to the need to be prepared to respond to natural disasters. He said that on the day that the storm struck, he spoke with a senior White House official and told them that his worst nightmare had occurred and that the city was flooding. But he was convinced that because it was not a terrorist attack, that it was not going to get the sufficient response from the federal government.
Who was that senior White House official? Some reports seem to be suggesting that it was the president.
No, he did not say that he spoke with the president. He said that he believes he spoke with Joe Hagan, the deputy chief of staff, or perhaps Andy Card, the chief of staff. He says he cannot recollect explicitly, but it was not the president himself.
What is the White House saying about all this?
The White House is saying that there were conflicting reports that were coming in on Monday and into Monday night, some of which were saying that the levee had been breached, some of which were saying that there was simply severe flooding. What FEMA had was a FEMA official on the ground who had flown over in a helicopter the 17th Street Canal where the levee breach had occurred, not only and taken a photograph that clearly showed that the levee had breached and that the city was flooding severely.
Again, with regard to the comparison between the seriousness with which natural disasters were taken as opposed to terrorism organizations, I understand that Mr. Brown said that if there had been a bomb on the levees and that was what destroyed them, that there might have been a much more serious effort.
Yeah, he expressed repeated frustration with his inability to get sufficient financing and other resources to do the kind of job that he needed to do as FEMA director. But at the same time, a number of the members of the Senate committee were criticizing him and saying a lot of this is your fault and that you were not properly communicating with, for example, the Homeland Security Secretary Chertoff, that you were not asking for additional resources, and that they felt as if he was the one that largely deserved the blame.
We're talking to Eric Lipton, who covers Homeland Security for the New York Times. Didn't one senator, though, say, it sounds to me like you, Mr. Brown, are being made a scapegoat?
It was a bit of a back and forth. In fact, the Republicans generally were saying that Mr. Brown was largely responsible for not properly communicating, and the Democrats were saying that they felt as if he was being made into a scapegoat.
So the hearing, as I understand it, has now adjourned. What happens next? Is there going to be legislation? Is the administration going to take the initiative and make some changes in the Department of Homeland Security?
There are three different entities that are studying the Katrina failures. The White House is doing its own report. The House and the Senate are both doing investigations. Those reports are going to start to come out quite soon. The first one, for sure, will be next week.
Mr. Brown had said before this hearing began that if he didn't get some help from the White House in terms of help for particularly his legal representation, that he was going to reveal emails and sounded like, I'm going to blow the lid off this town. Did he in fact do that?
He did. After some conversations with Senator Collins of Maine, the chairwoman of the committee, he did agree to discuss his conversations with White House senior aides, and he also shared some emails that he'd sent. And that was in that context that he did say that he recollected, as best he could remember, that he spoke with Joe Hagan the night of the Katrina hit on Monday and told him that the city was flooding. At first, he said he wasn't sure if he said the levees had failed, but later he said that he told Hagan that the levees had failed and the city was flooding.
Your paper, the New York Times, with your byline, Eric Lipton, wrote to this effect in today's paper. I'd understand Scott McClellan, the White House press secretary, says you're rewriting history.
They feel as if there was conflicting information and that they did not have a clear picture that the levee had failed. And that is their position. But what we have are emails that went to the Assistant Secretary of Homeland Security on that Monday of the storm hitting that clearly state that a FEMA official had seen the levee breach. And we also have a report that was issued Monday night by the Homeland Security Department that said that the levee had breached. And we know that report reached the White House late Monday at around midnight. So we have these documents that say that the White House and the Homeland Security Secretary's office was informed of the levee breach on Monday. Their response is that they had conflicting information and they couldn't act on that conflicting information.
All right. And Mr. Brown, of course, is saying that they did know because, once again, he told them.
He said that he said in, when he was asked about this the second time that he told Joe Hagan that the levee had been breached.
Eric Lipton, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Again, a reporter who covers Homeland Security for The New York Times. In a moment, where are the rocket scientists when we need them? We'll talk about the president's competitiveness initiative on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Armin Alney back with To the Point. Among high school seniors in the world's top countries, the United States ranks 16th in science and 19th in math. That's out of the top 21 countries in the United States. U.S. companies prefer the technical skills of Chinese workers and the innovation of researchers from India. Richard Garnick is president of North American Services for Keen. That's a company that deals in business processes and information technology. And yesterday, he testified to a congressional committee about the challenges facing the country. Mr. Garnick, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
What's the nature of these challenges? How serious are they?
Well, first, let's start off with that India and China's success is not in and of itself a failing on America. There is just as many opportunities as there are challenges. But I know the session yesterday and the dialogue is focused on the competitive impact in the 21st century on America. What are the challenges?
So you're saying, in other words, this is not a zero-sum situation.
No, it is not a zero-sum, and we want to make sure that the language and dialogue around this discussion is balanced in its view. And, during the political campaign of the last presidential election, there tended to be more rhetoric versus enlightened facts as to what the opportunities are also.
Okay. Well, let's hear first the enlightened facts about the challenges that we are facing. That's always, of course, what we focus on in the news.
Okay. Fundamentally, the challenge as we see it is that, India is producing 300,000 engineering graduates a year, China a 250,000 engineers a year, and here in America, we've been averaging about 65,000 to 70,000 engineers a year coming out of our college graduate programs. In addition, we have some other challenges in the fact that over 50% of the doctoral degrees in computer science and the hard sciences go to foreign nationals here in North America. And in fact, in the engineering world, even a higher percentage, over 60% is estimated degrees go to foreign nationals. And the challenge is that we in America are not producing enough engineering talent, and long term, there's going to be an impact on our competitive lead in technology.
Do those foreign nationals that get 50% of American doctorates stay in this country, or do they go home?
historically, they have been staying, but the trends over the recent time, because the markets of their home countries is growing disproportionately faster than it is here in North America, many of them are repatriating back to their home countries. And what leaves is not only the individual, but the knowledge that they gain from American innovation.
When you say there are 350,000 engineers graduating in India, 250,000 graduating in China, as opposed to 65,000 in the United States, is that partly just due to population differences?
Obviously, some of it is, you know, a straight law of large numbers that, you know, we in America are a 300 million population versus over a billion in both those countries. However, the bigger issue is the velocity of change. Only the last 5 years has seen a tremendous increase in the growth in both those countries. So long term, we don't know yet what that impact will be, but if you project forward what that could lead to, there are some potential ramifications strategically. Some of the things we spoke about yesterday was that here in America, we need to leverage a larger portion of the population that is not inclined to go into the engineering and sciences. And that is women have dropped in the percentage of people participating in the technology field from 41% to 32% since 96. And African Americans and Hispanics are underrepresented at just 4% of Hispanics and 3% of African Americans are participating in the technology fields.
What about the new competitive initiative announced by the president? Do you think that's going to do the job?
Well, I think it's a little bit early to say it's going to do the job. I very much support and think that it's a great step that we are raising the level of dialogue on this important issue, not only in my role as a leader in the technology, but I also sit on the board of ITAA, which is an association that represents 325 of the leading technology companies in North America. And all of these companies are impacted by the talent base we have to draw upon to allow our companies to prosper.
What if we don't increase the talent base, as you call it? And what if we don't get more people, whether they're women, minority people, or others, into math and science? What's liable to happen?
Well, I think the impact will be a slowing of growth, a potential closing of our competitive lead in various businesses, ranging from computing to telecommunications to new industries that are emerging, such as nanotechnology and others. And then, obviously, there's potential impact on our national security down the road. It's clear that our military is not the strongest in the world because of our sheer size, but it's because of the innovations and technological lead that we hold over other countries in the world.
Again, Richard Garnick is president of Keen. That's a business process and information technology firm, testified yesterday before the House Committee on Government Reform. Let me introduce Rajesh Sethi. He is chairman of Cygnex Technology in Silicon Valley. That's a software company that builds open source solutions. He himself was raised and educated in Bangalore, India, where he got an engineering degree. His latest book is entitled Beyond Code. Mr. Sethi, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Warren. I'm happy to be here.
Tell us a bit about your education in India, about the culture that exists there in the context in which we speak.
Excellent. You know, I always go back to my younger days where my parents would ask me, Rajesh, do you want to be a doctor or do you want to be an engineer? It's almost like those were the two choices that I had. And everyone that was growing up with me, all the kids, my other kids in the neighborhood, everyone, the same question was being asked, do you want to be a doctor or do you want to be an engineer? So when I was growing up, it was almost like I should pick one, a doctor or engineer. And I was not good in drawing, so the biology was a hard one for me, so I picked engineering. And it's the same thing everywhere. Education is given so much high importance within our family or within every family that I know of in India that it's the key thing. And as you know, that parents almost sponsor education. That means they pay for education until graduation or until post-graduation. So the kids there, they don't have anything else but to study. There is no other thing that they have to worry about, how do we pay for education and those kinds of things. that makes a huge difference in whatever we choose to do.
Well, if parents have to pay, then does that work a disadvantage for those who are unable to pay?
You are right. Like Richard said, the population plays a big role. So there are cases where people do earn and pay, but you have a point there that not everyone can go and afford the engineering and or the medical education because it's quite expensive there. So that's why there is this difference between the haves and have-nots in any of the developing country.
Is one of the motivations for this concern about education and for this choice, such as the one you were given, that you could be either a doctor or an engineer, is that driven in part by the desire of the country to be economically competitive?
I think at a global level you can say that, but it's not like people are thinking at the macro things. They're just thinking, you know, what is everybody else doing? It's like, what is my neighbor doing? Everyone is going after doctor or engineer. So it's almost like it's a massive thing that's happening. That's, people are not thinking, okay, so if all our children become doctors or engineers, so as a country, we will progress. They are not thinking at those levels. They're just thinking, what is everyone doing around them?
Rajesh Sethi, once again, chairman of Signex Technology in Silicon Valley. Richard Garnick, back to you with the president of Keen. Interested in your comments on what we're hearing from Rajesh Sethi. Is that the kind of environment, the kind of culture, if that's the right term, you'd like to see more of in the United States?
Well, I think it's clear that it's a strong foundation that comes from the family and a focus on education that has bolstered the society in India. I spent the last 5 years pretty much living in Bangalore, actually. I was a leader of a large IT services firm out of India, and we have a few thousand people there with Keen. And it is an extreme focus because I think it's a clear opportunity to uplift their society out of poverty. And it's a focus at every level in India versus in America, our children aspire to become athletes or pop stars because it's seen as a way to get ahead in the society. Today, engineering and teaching is not viewed in our society as a step up or something that is to be revered. And I think it is to our detriment long term that we are not focusing on education, teachers, and the engineering and the sciences.
Are we complacent as a society in this regard?
I don't want to say we're complacent because we are the economy that is the locomotive of the train across the globe. I think it's a natural phenomenon of the leader to be in the position we're in, and others that have a far and a large gap are going to be working a little bit harder, a little bit of the old Avis. We're number two, we'll try harder. So I think that's a natural phenomenon. I don't think we want to underestimate the American ingenuity, the American people. I think we'll continue to lead the world. It's just a matter of how large that gap will be, and we don't have a monopoly or a preordained right to dominate the world economic platform.
Back to Mr. Sethi at Signex Technology. You were educated in India. You came here. Others, as we heard earlier from Richard Garnick, are being educated here and then going home. What's the balance? Do you think that most people who are of Indian descent, such as yourself, are going to end up in India and strengthening that economy rather than being here?
Yes, it's a mixed feeling that it all depends on person to person. There is no standard rule for somebody that they have to go back. Just like there is no standard rule that somebody will stay here, that what you should see is that many people came here because of the economic opportunities that this land presented. And if that was the main reason, if so many more opportunities are opening back in India, the key fact that, okay, there is a big opportunity out there, let me go to United States, that thing is no longer valid. So there is a strong tendency for many people to say, you know what, let me go back. And the family is there, the friends are there, so now there are opportunities there.
Does your presence here, where you're chair of a big company, Signex Technology in Silicon Valley, indicate that, as we have heard, American companies sometimes would rather see people such as yourself from India or people from China because they provide the kinds of skills and the kind of approach to things that they're not getting from American graduates.
I think there is enough talent here and there is enough talent there, and because of the technology, the boundaries are no longer there. It's almost like if you look at many companies, being in the Bay Area, I see many companies where the teams are becoming more global. It's almost like where you are physically does not matter anymore. So it's the physical presence is good, but if a person is in China or India, it doesn't affect the project that they're working on.
Rajesh Sethi with Signex Technologies. Let me introduce our next guest and say, if I may, that we're going to have to go away for a break very soon, but I want to give Deborah Wintz-Smith an opportunity to tell us just at the outset, very quickly, what are the outlines of the president's competitive initiative. She herself is president of the Council on Competitiveness. That's a think tank representing CEOs and university presidents and labor leaders and others who have helped to open the debate about this issue. Deborah Wintz-Smith, welcome to you.
Thank you.
As quickly as you can, what are the major features of the president's initiative, competitiveness initiative?
Well, I think the first thing that's very, very important is that this is really a tipping point and a turning point in bringing to the American people the fact that our future, the lives of our children, and our security really depends on our being innovative and pushing the frontiers of knowledge and having the skills to do that. We are not going to maintain our productivity if we compete on low wages, standardized commodities, projects, or services. The only way we will continue to see the fantastic productivity in the U.S., which is quite frankly unparalleled in the world, and our economic growth is through this relentless innovation capacity. And the president very importantly framed the commitment to new investments and accelerated investments in R&D and education and some important tax policies under the framework of competitiveness and innovation. And I think that this underscores the very, very strong bipartisan support for addressing these issues across the country in a very concrete way, but one that gives us a path into the future.
All right. We will continue, as I said, with this conversation. Ms. Smith has indicated she thinks the president's going in the right direction. We'll find out a little bit more about what that means and talk to others as well as we continue on To the Point. On Reporter's Notebook a bit later, an ignominious resignation at the world's richest art institution. We'll hear about the Getty Trust in Los Angeles. Back in a minute with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from The Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
We're only back with To the Point. We're talking today about what the president has referred to as his new competitiveness initiative and whether or not it is appropriately designed to deal with the challenges faced now by the United States, such a leader, as we all know, particularly since Sputnik, in technology and advancement of that kind, now threatened, according to a couple of our recent guests, by the advancement of other countries and the failure, at the moment at least, for the United States from an educational standpoint to be keeping up. Deborah Wintz-Smith, once again, is president of the Council on Competitiveness. You said this is a tipping point. What exactly is the president proposing to do, and is it a tipping point, in the sense that it's a beginning, or is this going to be enough, as I phrased the question earlier, to do the job?
Well, clearly what the president is proposing is a beginning, and it's over a long period of years. Let me just start with the research and development component. This nation spends overall 2.6% of our GDP on research and development. And out of that, and that's a very big number. In fact, we spend more on research and development than the rest of the G7 combined, and our total R&D spending has doubled since 1990. And one of the recent figures we have in 2004 is we're spending about $312 billion on research and development.
So what should we be worried about then?
But the key thing I want to say here is that the frontier research, the over-the-horizon research in nanotechnology and supercomputing, in all the areas that are going to really create the new industries and services that we can't even contemplate today, have been supported traditionally by the government. And what the president has done is made a very, very strong commitment to accelerate the government's investment in the math, physical, and engineering societies, and indeed double these investments over the next 10 years in the National Science Foundation, the Department of Energy's Office of Science, NIST, and restore the Department of Defense's investment in basic research as well. So this is a very important, critical direction, and quite frankly, no country in the world, in my view, is going to be able to devote those types of resources in the networked system we have of universities, industries, and national laboratories to work at the frontier. And then the second component, of course, that we've been discussing on this program is the talent to actually participate in both that knowledge creation and how it is commercialized to create new value. So the educational component of encouraging and actually doing some concrete things to get more American students into math, science, and engineering, and really to start that at the earliest grades in K through 12, because, you know, we're not talking about only having, you know, PhD scientists and engineers. We're talking about having a very high-performing workforce, and these skills are essential to be able to compete in a highly technologically dependent economy. So the focus on math, science, and engineering is important in a concrete sense. It's also important very, very symbolically.
Deborah Wentz-Smith, once again, President of the Council on Competitiveness. We'll come back to her in a moment. I want to introduce now Janet Murguia, President and CEO of the National Council of La Raza, former Executive Vice Chancellor for External Affairs at the University of Kansas. Ms. Murguia, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
There's a cost to all of this, one would assume, because in addition to what we're hearing about the competitiveness initiative, there are also reductions being made in the budget to current educational programs. Tell us a bit about that and to what extent you think that's going to impact on this effort to build a high-performance workforce.
Yes. We recognize that to be a truly competitive nation, we have to have an educated workforce, yet we're disappointed at the National Council of RASA, the largest Hispanic civil rights and advocacy organization for Hispanics today, in President Bush's budget, in that it eliminates some key and acclaimed programs that have helped Latino children finish high school and go on to college. So programs such as Gear Up, TRIO, and Upward Bound that have been proven programs for our community, to see these kinds of not just cuts but elimination is extremely distressing for us. We also recognize to be a competitive economy requires skilled workers, yet we were extremely disappointed to see that this budget not just cuts but eliminates job training for some of the key segments of the Hispanic community. Example is a job training program for migrant workers, a proven program which has helped thousands get out of the fields and into many 21st century labor market positions. So, you know, I think that it's a little distressing to see the fact that we're claiming to do more in order to have us be a competitive nation, but we're seeing cuts, not just cuts, but actual elimination of programs that we have seen for the Hispanic community, you know, be proven programs. And I would just add that if you look at the demographics, you see the growth in the Hispanic population. I mean, the census figures in this last round pointed out for the first time the Latino community is the largest minority community now in the country. I would argue that if you're not making investments now into that demographic community, then you're not looking long-term at what your workforce needs that will allow you to be truly competitive. So, yes, we're very concerned about some of the the cuts that we've seen in this budget, but we do want to continue to work with the administration and hope that they will recognize that some of these are very proven programs and that the Congress will actually fund them.
Would the same analysis hold for people who are not Hispanic, but who are also minorities or the children of the working poor who are of different ethnicities than Hispanic people?
Clearly. I mean, I think we have to look at all the communities of color and see where the best programs have been proven to show that they have allowed them to be successful when it comes to education or job skill training. I would argue that we need a lot of increased investments, not just slight cuts or eliminations, obviously, in areas like early child education. We could see that if we invest long-term in some of those types of programs, you're helping a community of color, but kids in all socioeconomic classes to be able to be more successful. So, yes, I don't think it's just about the Hispanic community, but I do think that we have to look at the demographics, and if it is going to be a certain segment of the population based on what we're seeing growth in terms of population rates, then we ought to be seeing that as an early indicator of where we need to make investments, because those populations are going to be the ones that, for instance, are sustaining Social Security over the long term. And if we aren't investing to match them in the right education programs or the right jobs training programs, then we're being very short-sighted. And now's the time to really make investments on the front end with those populations.
Janet Murguia, once again, now President and CEO of La Raza, formerly with the University of Kansas. Back to Deborah Wentz Smith. Are you concerned about this? Is the president, in a sense, giving with one hand, taking back with the other?
Well, I want to comment on the whole challenge of workforce development, because there's no question that our future workforce and demographics indeed include a very large growing Hispanic population. And I think one of the issues that is underway now, and this is something the Council on Competitiveness has taken a very, very strong leadership role on, is how we integrate workforce development programs with economic development programs, the K through 12, in communities and regions of our country. You know, we forget that, I think a lot of people forget, we're spending $22 billion a year on workforce development. And most of that money is going to training for jobs that will not exist in this country. And
What do you mean? What kind of jobs?
Well, a lot of remedial, low-cost manufacturing jobs, and you know, that are moving offshore. And so getting a workforce that is really able, for instance, in 21st century manufacturing, which is being incubated in this country, you know, there are going to be many, many jobs that involve the analytical, problem-solving, and computer-based skills that we have to start very, very early in our educational program. So one of the things I think that we all need to be doing is in our communities really galvanizing the partnerships and the integration that starts in this pre-K and moves all the way up to workforce. Community colleges, they are a huge delivery system for our Hispanic population, and a lot of work's been shown the types of outcomes when you have these community colleges that are vibrant in communities. Very, very important part. And the other thing I would like to say is, you know, when we think of the integration of North America and what's happening, you know, in the aftermath of NAFTA, it was very interesting in our hearing yesterday that our Secretary of Commerce, Secretary Gutierrez, and the CEO of AMD, you know, great IT company, Hector Ruiz, were originally from Mexico, and from very modest backgrounds. And they talked about, Secretary Gutierrez was from Cuba, but they talked about the whole process of they came here, they developed the skills, the entrepreneurships to be, you know, at the highest levels of our government and our industry.
I understand what you're saying, but what about Ms. Murguia was saying about programs like Gear Up and TRIO and Upward Bound, the training of migrant workers and so on? Aren't those programs that are at the very basic level to try to get people in a position where they can go to community college and other such things? Does it make sense to get rid of them?
Well, I'm not, you know, quite frankly, an expert on those very, very early programs. What I will say is that communities themselves really need to step up to the plate as do, you know, all the constituencies that support these things to invest in their future workforce and education.
Okay, let me go back to Janet Murguia. What about attitudes toward education in the Hispanic community and in other communities as well?
I'd like to point something out, though. I mean, I think, you know, I think communities are stepping up. We have more and more Hispanics attempting to get into higher education. I'm glad that Deborah Winsmith acknowledged community colleges. But what's extremely disturbing to see in this president's budget, I'd love to hear her response, but to see the cuts in higher education and student financial assistance. Our community, the Latino community, rely on student financial aid more than any other community. And under the President Bush's proposal, student financial assistance would plunge to $13.7 billion in 2010 from $19.2 billion this year. By the end of the decade, higher education assistance would be cut nearly in half to $1.1 billion from $2 billion. Now, we can have all the will in the world as a community to step up, but if at some point we aren't seeing some intervention and investments from this from our country into this workforce, into this community, all the will in the world cannot solve that. And I know about coming from immigrant parents and making it all the way into the West Wing of the White House, which was my position in an earlier administration. But I would argue that at some point you have to see the dollars, you have to see the policies that are really the positive policies that have been proven, and you can't just say you have to have community step up.
Ms. Smith, you indicated you're not familiar in detail with some of these programs, but what about the idea of reducing financial aid for higher education by that much, from $19 billion down to $13 billion?
Well, we certainly have a tremendous program in this country of financial aid for education, and it's very much based on need. And I know that there are states like Georgia, you know, that have the HOPE scholarship program, that every student that has a maintains a B average, you know, has their whole education paid for. So, you know, the federal government has, again, a very important responsibility and tremendous resources going out to the states. But I would argue, since our educational system is locally based, state based, that they have responsibility as well to invest in all of this. And there are wonderful models in different parts of the country to do that. I will cite the example in Dallas, Texas, where some of the high-tech leaders and entrepreneurs have put together foundation money. And what they've done is invested in giving both skill training and more salaries to math science teachers who are reaching down into the most poor inner-city schools in Dallas to expose these young children to the skills they need, and they're having fantastic outcomes. As
okay, let me go back
teacher.
To as Ms. Murguia. I beg your pardon. I don't know why I'm stumbling over your name. It's an easy name to pronounce, Murguia. Back to the question of Texas. A lot of Hispanic people, obviously, in Texas. Is that a model?
Well, I'm in Texas as we speak right now. I happen to be in San Antonio, Texas. I just visited a university campus, and I will just tell you that there can be some model programs we can look to, but at the end of the day, we need leadership at a national level when it comes to student financial assistance, and we need investments that are led by the administration and ultimately by the president to make a case for increasing higher education assistance and student financial aid. Too many individuals, unfortunately, still rely on some form of assistance to be able to make it to the next level of education. And that leadership has to come at the federal level. And we need to see those numbers going up, not going down, by the end of the decade. And it's very disturbing because even as Deborah Winsmith acknowledged, you know, you can have all of these big aspirations when it comes to innovation capacity. But if you aren't giving every segment of the population in this country a chance to be able to be part of that innovation, and to make those contributions, not just economic, but innovative contributions, then we're really shortchanging ourselves as a society. And it's something that I don't really understand at all. These cuts in higher education and student financial aid programs, which virtually everyone who comes from a community of color background recognizes how important it is. Maybe it can't fund their entire education, but even if you're working hard and getting scholarships, you still need that additional assistance. And that leadership must come at the federal level.
Earlier we heard from Rajesh Sethi, who was raised and educated in India about the culture there and how there was a choice between being a doctor or an engineer, and that was pretty much it. And everybody was encouraged to go in that direction, obviously somewhat different from the community you're talking about in that he said, obviously, parents are able to pay for education there and amongst the obviously elite part of the country. That may not be who we're talking about in the United States. But isn't it also true, Ms. Murguia, that it is important for local, at the grassroots, for people in the community to try to generate a culture that values education, that gets people thinking in the appropriate terms, such as you did yourself?
Absolutely, and I'll point out another point in the president's budget. And you know, I won't say that there's everything bad in there, but I'm very distressed by what I see in the education budget. But to that very point that you just mentioned, for instance, to make sure that the No Child Left Behind Act, which is something that we have supported in the past because we believe it's important to have high standards, but if you can't fund that program at the level that it should be funded, then it's not going to do what we had hoped it would do. And one key area that was in the No Child Left Behind Act, which has been proposed to be eliminated, which would directly help when it comes to communities of color, but particularly what we've seen as a proven program for Latinos and for Hispanics, is the parental involvement piece. And there is a parental assistance program which allows more parents to be more involved and to be able to be more participants in their children's.
Okay, I understand the point. We're running short of time. Ms. Smith, very quickly, on that specific point, No Child Left Behind, there has been criticism that although the president started it, he hasn't funded it adequately. What about eliminating that particular program, which seems to go right to the issue you raised before about the communities?
Well, it's my understanding that the president wants the No Child Left Behind to be fully funded. So I'm not aware of any, you know, effort to eliminate any component of that. I will say that the workforce development component of what we're talking about is absolutely critical. You know, one of the mistakes.
Okay, I'm sorry, we're just out of time, and I just need to get a clarification from Ms. Murguia. What about it? You're saying that that element of No Child Left Behind is, in fact, being removed.
That's correct. The president's budget would level fund bilingual education and completely eliminate the parental assistance program.
All right. Obviously, there's going to be a lot of debate about this as time goes on. We will try to follow it and hope that all of you will be able to join us again. Again, Janet Murguia, now with the National Council of La Raza, president and CEO, formerly with the University of Kansas. Deborah Wintz-Smith, president on the Council of Competitiveness, think tank that represents CEOs, university presidents, and others. And our earlier guests, Rajesh Sethi from Cigna Next Technology in Silicon Valley, and Richard Garnick at Keen, the business and information technology services firm. Thanks, all of you, very much for being with us today. Just last month, Barry Munitz presided over the reopening of the Getty Villa, an extraordinary museum of antiquities in Malibu. But just last night, Munitz resigned as head of the Getty Trust, which includes not only the villa, but other assets worth a total of $9 billion. In a moment, a dramatic rise and fall in the world of philanthropy on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Warman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. The resignation of Barry Munitz from the world's richest art institution, the Getty Trust, came after months of revelations that led to rebuke from a U.S. senator, an investigation by the Attorney General of California, and probation status from the Council on Foundations. Munitz departed without $1.2 million in severance pay that his contract called for, and in addition, he is repaying the Getty $250,000 to resolve what both parties are calling any continuing disputes. Jason Felch is an investigative reporter for the Los Angeles Times, which has been covering this situation for years, I think I can appropriately say, certainly for months, and has printed many articles on it. Jason Felch, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How did you, or how do you interpret what happened last night, and why do you think Mr. Munitz resigned in the way he did?
Well, I think, judging from the statements, the press release, but also the statements of the Getty's chairman of the board, John Biggs, it's clear that in the recent investigation led by the board, they came across or confirmed facts that and came to the conclusion that they felt that some of Munitz's spending was not appropriate, and apparently came to an agreement with Mr. Munitz that he would leave voluntarily, but also pay back some of those expenses.
Now, when it's said that this is to resolve any continuing disputes, should one assume from that, and of course it's a very generalized language, you don't know what they agreed to in private, but should we assume that there won't be any lawsuits by one party or the other?
Well, I think we can assume that that's part of the agreement. The money appears to be an agreed-upon ballpark figure for presumably what anything that the Attorney General, the State Attorney General, who's investigating the Getty, and more specifically Muniz's use of Getty's tax-exempt resources, anything that the Attorney General might find. So now it's that's not to say that if the Attorney General finds something inappropriate about the way Muniz used Getty's money, that they could not still pursue some course of action with Muniz or the Getty itself.
What are some of the examples that your paper has reported of what appear to have been regarded now, even by the board itself, as excessive spending?
Well, there was really a grab bag of things, many of which taken alone seem petty, perhaps, but they did add up to a larger picture in which Muniz appeared to be using trust resources for his own benefit. He traveled widely, first class, often luxury travel, with friends, many prominent L.A. people, Eli Broad, Richard Reardon, and would charge those trips to the Getty as business expenses. It wasn't always apparent what the business purpose of the trips were, and they were often very costly. Muniz often brought his wife with him on those trips. He took the authority to make grants through the Getty's grant-making group, the Getty Foundation, it's now called, and directed grants to projects that had an unclear link to the Getty's mission, which is admittedly broad. For example, funding a film by Davis Guggenheim about teachers in Los Angeles, an award-winning documentary film, but Muniz's chief of staff received an executive producer credit on the film, and it was apparently rushed through, according to our reporting, before receiving any of the approval, and Davis Guggenheim at the time did not have tax-exempt status, and therefore it was an illegal, or I should say, mm-hmm. an inappropriate grant. The process didn't follow its proper course.
So once again, Mr. Muniz has left. You mentioned John Biggs, the chair of the board, who said last fall about the trips and the other expenses, every time he spends some money, we want him to take a hard look at it and ask himself whether he would want that spending published, sort of a negative thing for the chair of the board to be saying at that point. Then again, the investigation was undertaken by the board, and it would appear that its results are what has led to his investigation, although Mr. Biggs, I gather, denied that.
Well, it's a real turnaround for the Getty's trustees. We've been reporting on the Getty for more than a year now, and throughout that, the board has stood strongly by Muniz and defended his spending by saying all of it was approved by the board, much of it had been indeed part of his contract for employment, and questioned many times the Times reporting and the significance of what we were reporting on. That attitude appears to have changed in recent months. We're piecing together exactly how that came about. But clearly, when the board in October appointed Ronald Olson, a Los Angeles attorney here, to investigate Muniz, it was clear that they were taking the Attorney General's investigation seriously. And I think in the statements made by Mr. Biggs and others after Muniz's resignation, it's clear that they themselves came to the clear conclusion that some of his behavior was inappropriate.
Again, Jason Fels is an investigative reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Now, Mr. Getty spent 8 years Mr. Muniz spent 8 years at the Getty. Before that, for some years, he was the head of the state university system in California, which is an enormous institution. Prior to that, he was involved in a savings and loan issue in the state of Texas and associated with people who were under investigation by the authorities there, as a result of which, just as he was arriving at the Getty, Getty, it was determined that he would not be able to legally be involved in the bank business in Texas. Do you think that the trustees and others now are going to look back at that history?
You know, I think that that was something the trustees were aware of. That investigation was ongoing when they hired Munitz. My understanding is the trustees and the chairman of the board at the time, Bob Urberu, took a very close look at Munitz's role in that and came to the conclusion that that they would go ahead and hire him, despite the allegations at the time. About a year after he had started at the Getty, the company that he was associated with agreed to pay a $1 million restitution settlement. So, you know, critics of Munitz will look back both over his time at CSU and over the Maxam and savings and loan scandal and see a pattern of behavior here and perhaps the misappropriate use of, of funds.
All right. Much more will be heard about this in days to come. Meantime, Jason Felch with the Los Angeles Times, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you, Warren.
Producers of To the Point, Francis Anderton, Christian Bordahl, Katie Cooper, Jonah King, Sharon Rimbaum, managing producer Karen Radziner. Special thanks to Greg Goodfellow. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family. Our technical director is J.P. Costello. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.